Welcome, everybody. This is the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. This is Lecture 1, broadcasting on April 24, 2014. In this lecture, we're talking about socialism, the theory and the practice. So here's the outline of what we're doing tonight. Okay. I'm not going to – yeah, recording's going. I'm not going to – I'll just spend like literally 1 minute on this. In case anybody's new, make sure you're getting the email blasts regarding this course. We're not going to spam you. I think maybe you'll get 2 a week if you're getting them, because I'll announce – what's going to happen is there's Saturday – office hours, and there's also weekly quizzes, and both of these are optional. So meaning the Saturday office hours is just I show up for an hour window on Saturdays. I will announce beforehand when that's going to be. The time varies from week to week depending on my schedule, one thing, but also I want to vary it in case you guys have regular commitments, and so to give a window for other people so someone doesn't have to miss every single time. Those are completely optional. You can take this class even if you're taking it for credit and never attend and never even watch the videos and get 100%. All right, so I'm never going to quiz you on something you won't know if you watch the videos from the Saturday deal. But they're also open-ended. For whatever reason, some people tell me they pay the $59 or whatever it is to enroll my courses just to come to the Saturday thing. So I don't know if it's because my Saturday thing is so awesome or because the normal canned lecture is so awful. Who knows? Relative ranking, but in any event, some people say those are fun, and it's off the cuff. You can ask me anything you want. Weekly quizzes, they're optional in the sense if you want a grade in this course, make sure you take the weekly quizzes. But if you don't want credit, just don't take it, and we'll get the hint. Okay. So anyway, all that stuff you'll be getting the information you need if you're new here. Don't worry about it in the weekly updates the emails you'll be getting. And so make sure you're getting those emails if you want to be in the loop. One last bit of housekeeping. Let me just make sure people don't get intimidated, because occasionally we do pick up new enrollees and they don't know what's going on. If the main textbook for this class, and that's why I've got it on the slide, is this book right here. The PDF is free online, so you can – you know, if you're in a jam, you don't got to wait for it to come in the mail. I would recommend that you get the physical book if you don't already own it, because it's much easier to read that way. Also, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, I want people to buy my book. But in all seriousness, I think it's easier for you to be studying from that. But in addition, because we're doing these online classes to people who are fans of the Mises Institute, presumably, or the Austrian school at least, I don't want to just stick to the textbook. And so you're going to see in these lectures occasionally, depending on the topic, I might give the whole lecture and very, very rarely refer to the stuff that's literally in the textbook. Like tonight's lecture, for example, a lot of what I'm going to say, you're not going to be able to say, wait, what page is that on in the textbook? And you're not going to see it. All right. I mean, it's the same subject matter, but I'm going to be talking about drawing on things relevant to people who like Austrian economics, but not necessarily that was directly discussed in the textbook, right? And so the way to get the most out of this class is to read the assigned readings first before the lectures and then hear the lecture. Obviously, if you didn't read it this week, it's fine. It's not going to kill you. But optimally, that's the way you want to do it, as opposed to hearing the lecture first and then doing the reading. If you're going to do it one way or the other, do it. Do the reading beforehand. You'll get much more out of it. Because, again, a lot of what I'm going to say is not directly in the textbook, so you'll be much better off if you have that foundation and then you hear me say stuff. One last thing regarding that, especially like if you're a homeschool kid and I'm saying if some things that sound a little bit advanced to you that's not in the textbook or in the other supplemental readings, don't panic. You know, a lot of times I might just throw in some background information orally during the lecture. But it's not like I'm going to go test you on that, all right? So if you're taking this and your mom or dad or somebody is making you take things for credit, and that somehow counts as an official and you're getting worried about the pressure, as long as you really understand the textbook and the kind of questions that are there, you should do well. And the weekly quizzes also give you an idea of are you absorbing the important points. All right, so it's not necessary that you understand every little last clause in the things that I say during these lectures. Okay, so the socialism debate, tonight I'm going to focus mostly on this, like the theoretical socialist debate in terms of the academic economists going back and forth and the arguments pro and con for socialism. For one thing, because I think that's most relevant in terms of people wanting to understand the contributions of the Austrian school, but also it's, you can read the textbook in terms of the empirical body counts and stuff like that. I'm not going to spend too much time on that stuff because you can just go in the textbook and see all the statistics. So there's no point in me just going over that. I don't really need to tell you how to read a number off a table, but I do want to make sure you guys understand the historical context of what we now call the socialist calculation debate. Okay, so this picture right there, that's Nikita Khrushchev, yes, because he famously took his shoe off and was banging a table one time saying that the Soviet Union was going to bury the West. Okay, so let me set the stage. We're trying to explain, or what I'm trying to do right now is to get you to see historically what were the arguments about socialism before Ludwig von Mises came out of the scene. I suppose, let me take a step back. What is socialism? I was sort of assuming that. I didn't devote a slide to it, but it's so what is socialism? It's been called the command economy. All right, and so if you'll notice the section headings in the textbook, it kind of worked out nicely that we had capitalism, that's also known as the market economy, and that was what the second quarter of the book, and then the third quarter deals with socialism, or what's called the command economy, and then the last quarter of the book deals with interventionism, or what is often called the mixed economy. All right, so that was just kind of neat the way that worked out. There's that symmetry there in the way the labels go. So with socialism, there's different versions of it. And for our purposes, it's not really important for you to study the particular differentiations and to know the various nomenclature. Let me just warn you, though, because I don't want you to walk blindly into an argument with some socialists and get caught flat-footed, and I would feel bad that I didn't prepare you well for going into intellectual battle. So just as I'm guessing a lot of you are probably libertarians or voluntarists or anarcho-capitalists or some word like that, and that you bristle and get angry when somebody like Rachel Maddow makes sweeping statements thinking that your philosophy is the same as Glenn Beck or the same as Rush Limbaugh or something like that, and then, you know, lumping you all together and she really doesn't know what she's talking about and all the fine distinctions in your camp and among the people, you know, that kind of thing. So by the same token, just be careful if you ever start arguing with people. Somebody who actually believes in socialism also is going to have all those 19,000 different categories. It's just like religion. You know, I mean, you could say atheist versus theist, and then Christian, Muslim, Jewish, a few things, you know, Buddhist. But then, you know, even among Christians, you know, they will have bitter, bitter arguments over various, you know, it's almost like the closer you get doctrinally, the more that one little disagreement matters. Okay, so it's the same thing with political and economic worldviews. Just as libertarians will slit each other's throats over fractional reserve banking if they agree on 99.9% of everything else, it's the same thing, I don't know what you want to call it, sociologically with self-described socialists, right? So socialism, Marxism, communism, to some of you, you might think those terms are interchangeable. Well, not to a socialist, a communist, or a Marxist, they're not interchangeable. They mean specific things, and they would get huffy and roll their eyes and think you were an idiot if you just started lumping them all together. All right. So I'm just, like I say, for our purposes, we don't need to get into the fine distinctions. So I'm not going to start going through it. That's not the point of this class. But I just want to give you that warning. Don't make a fool of yourself if you start arguing with actual Marxists online. Okay. So for our purposes, what does socialism have to mean, or else this discussion doesn't really make much sense, is that the government owns the means of production. Okay. So socialism, I don't know if you guys had not seen it if I hadn't closed the text box, but now you should see all that stuff. Okay, so socialism is command economy, and then the definition for what we mean by socialism in this discussion when I'm talking about Mises, well, a necessary element of it is that the government owns the means of production. And by the means of production, we mean the factories, big machinery, tools, equipment, farmland, things like that. Okay, so as I say, depending on which socialist writer you're reading, it could mean more or less than that. Well, it could mean more than that. It can't mean less than that, otherwise it's not really socialism. So some people might have outright government owns everything. There's literally no private property at all. Either money doesn't exist or there's some nominal thing that's like money, but it's just like an internal accounting system, and that even craftsmen don't own their individual tools, and the individual consumer, the household, is, you know, they don't, or even if it's not a house, if you're in an apartment somewhere in, you know, government projects, that you literally don't even own the clothes on your back. Okay, that could be the most extreme form of just pure, unadulterated government owns everything. Okay, so what I'm trying to get you to see is, in practice, a lot of the socialist writers did not advocate that extreme form of socialism. And it makes sense rhetorically or strategically if you're trying to gin up outrage among the workers. You probably don't want to be talking about, yeah, wouldn't it be great if the government owned your toothbrush and you literally didn't even own the table in your apartment? Because that would kind of like, well, I don't know. What you want to gin up is, we're going to dispossess the capitalists with the top hats, or the big land, the absentee landlords who own all this land that you're tilling and have to send them monthly rental payments. We're going to take the land from them and redistribute it among the people through, you know, agrarian reform, redistribution, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what would get the support of the masses. But to actually advocate this complete totalitarian, the state literally owns every last tangible piece of property, it's hard to get a lot of people behind that. Okay, so that's another thing that I'm warning in terms of the nuances of this. In practice, a lot of the socialist writers described a world or a society where the state would own the factories and would own the heavy equipment, you know, the backhoes and cement mixers and things like that. But peasants might even be able to own a little bit of land, possibly, depending on the writer. And certainly, a lot of the small artisans would own their tools and things. Okay, or just like the skilled craftsmen would be able to own their tools in a lot of these proposals. And there would still be markets where the workers would get paid money from the state, and then they would go into shops and buy stuff with money, and then they would own that property. So it's not like the government literally had everybody produce a big pile of stuff, and then bureaucrats came out and then parceled out all of social output to everybody based on some criteria. That's not – very few writers literally advocated such a system, even though you could say theoretically that's kind of what they were doing. What I'm saying is, in practice, most people realize that would really be impractical. All right, so for what it's worth, I just want you to be aware of those distinctions. Okay, but like I say, to be socialism as opposed to a heavily interventionist state in an otherwise market economy, it really, there needs to be a line somewhere until the government owns the means of production. Now, one time, Murray Rothbard said that he asked Mises, okay, look, there's a spectrum, obviously, that you have outright totalitarian government, the state just controls everything on the one hand, and then you've got lesser forms of socialism, you know, then you can imagine like a totally free market on the other hand, and, you know, like the United States, I don't know when Rothbard asked this, probably like in the 50s or 60s, somewhere around then, I'm guessing, is obviously not a free market utopia, but on the other hand, it's a lot different from the USSR at that point. And so Rothbard, in what we're reporting, because Rothbard wrote this somewhere, you know, he explained after, you know, relayed what happened, and apparently he said to Mises, is there a bright line on this spectrum that, for, you know, so that you would say on one side of this line, we're talking about basically a market economy that may have a lot of government intervention and distortion, but it's basically capitalism. Whereas on the other end, other side of that line, it's socialism, you know, maybe with pockets of black markets and things where the government kind of turns a blind eye and you have some vague ghost of markets at work, but it's basically socialism. And Rothbard says he didn't know if Mises was going to have an answer. He was afraid Mises was just going to say, well, no, it's just kind of, you know, there's no way to draw a line. But he said Mises gave him a crisp answer that if there's a stock market, it's a capitalist system. All right, stock market meaning a market in shares of ownership of corporations. All right, and so for Mises, that was the bright line. He was saying if the state allows individuals to own major companies, then that's basically a capitalist system, a market economy. Whereas if that is just outlawed, then, you know, who are you fooling? Let's not kid ourselves. It's basically socialism. Okay. So now that I've defined what socialism is, so people were advocates of socialism for a while. Right? It's not that this debate just all of a sudden started even with the publication of Marx's works. Right? People had been socialists before Karl Marx. And largely in the 1800s, the arguments, so you could read what we would now call classical liberals, obviously writing against socialism. They were opposed to it. And then you could write the pro-socialist reform writers making their arguments for it. And I would say there were two main points they would bring up. So one point that I didn't write down here is just the fact that power corrupts. All right, so the classical liberal thinkers, or even just the conservatives, and those, remember, those, that's a distinction back then, that the classical, the conservatives were not classical liberals, the way we think of that term, but they were also not socialists. And they might have stressed this sort of argument about the nature of political power, and realizing that, no, and it's just, you study history, you do not want to give life and death power to a handful of experts, that's a horrifying idea, and they're going to abuse it. And so they would be against socialism just on that ground alone. All right, now people who are thinking more like economists could stress this argument about incentives, and that's why I put this picture of the garbage collector, is to say, well, wait a minute, if we have a system where the state basically controls production, because it owns the means of production, and so the state basically is determining ultimately what's going to get produced from the limited resources available, that's and that's where you get this term command economy from, as opposed to a market economy. All right, so in socialism, the economic order is ultimately structured top down. There is a group of elites who tell everybody else that this is what we're producing. And that's obviously not what happens in a market economy. Market economy is a very decentralized process where there is no group in charge of what are we going to produce with our limited resources. And so what people call the economic problem, there's different ways that these social systems answer that question. And so we've studied before how the market economy answers it. Decentralized private property guided by prices and the profit and loss signals that they generate. Whereas under socialism, there's the planner or planners, if it's plural, but ultimately there is a grand plan set up by a committee or an individual, and then everybody else has to fall in line and follow the plan. So just to make that work, obviously there's the state has to be very powerful to get everyone to bend to its will. And it has tremendous power over people just by the very nature of what they're doing. If you can tell everybody where they have to work and you can decide what gets produced and what doesn't, that's a lot of power for humans to have, right? And the Soviet Union, infamously, if you got out of line, the government didn't have to actually kill you, even though they did do that. They could just reassign you to work in Siberia, okay? So, I mean, just imagine if it were in the United States, if there was an outright socialist government and somebody was popping off and being a pain, they could just say, well, and the new plan is coming out next year. Guess what? You're now going to be working on an oil rig in Alaska somewhere, or, you know, off the Gulf of, in the Gulf of Mexico somewhere. So no one's going to hear from you again. All right. So that's you can see once you give that kind of power, and that's why people are so skeptical of things like socialized medicine, is that forget the efficiency arguments for a minute and what the price of a heart transplant is going to be. You do not want to have government officials be in charge of whether your aunt can get that kidney transplant or not, because if you're an outspoken critic of the government, you might think twice about speaking up if you know some bureaucrat can just make a decision and your aunt dies, right? So that's the conservative sort of objection. But now the incentives say something different. They're going to say, let's put aside the issue of what happens if bad people gain control. Because that's basically what the conservative objection is saying, is that you do not want to create positions that have this much power where some people have so much discretion over the lives of other people because, oh my gosh, what happens if a bad guy gets in charge? Then we are all in big trouble. Just because there's so much damage you can do. In contrast, in the market economy where the government's relatively weak, it doesn't really matter who's in charge. They can't do that much damage to us. Okay, so that's the incentive argument. The more economics argument, though, and again, here I'm just laying the foundation for you guys before Mises comes on the scene. This one said, wait a minute, output under socialism would collapse because of this issue of incentives. If people are not being remunerated based on their contributions in terms of output the way they are under a market economy, well, then why would people work as hard? And the sort of iconic way of getting that across, people say, who would pick up the garbage, right? In a socialist system, if the way the system works is from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. Okay, so that's the Marxist slogan. If that's what you put into practice, so what does that mean? That means the consumption goods that you're getting, services you're getting, are not based on what you contributed. And so if that's the case, if people put two and two together, well, wait a minute. if I'm getting, if the amount of food I get and the size of the house I get or the size of the apartment, whatever I get, and the car that I get and so forth, if it's based on how many kids I have and how far I live from the factory where I'm supposed to work, and it's not based on how valuable is my labor to society, that's not really one of the main considerations in the equation to figure out how much stuff I get, well, then what do I care about what my value to society is? Okay, so that's the incentive argument. So just to make it real colloquial for you guys, a lot of times teachers will get this point across to their students by saying, imagine if we use socialism in the grading process here. And so that at the end of the semester, you know, so I continue to give you guys quizzes, and then we took, you know, midterms and took the final exam. And then at the end of the semester, what I did is I took all the scores, added them all together, divided by the number of students, and gave each of you the same number grade that was the average, the, you know, the mean of how the class did. What would happen? And you know, every kid can realize that thinking about for 2 seconds, everybody would get a much worse grade in that outcome than they would under a individualistic meritocracy where your individual grade depends on your performance on the quizzes in the midterm and the final. It doesn't matter what other people's grades are. And yeah, that might be unfair. And some kids who have a natural advantage, or maybe their parents are rich and so they don't have to work and they can just study all day, or they're just naturally born with an intelligent mind or whatever. That may be unfair, but the idea is if we enforce complete uniformity and equality and egalitarianism in the grading system, the output, the effort put into studying and preparing for those quizzes and midterm and exam, final exam, would plummet. Not just the real smart kids would stop studying as much, but even the really weak students wouldn't study as much as they used to. So everybody's scores would drop. And so the average, it's possible, obviously the people who used to get A's are certainly going to get much lower grade, but even the people who used to get C's might end up failing now. All right, so that's the idea. So that's the simplified version of what this incentive argument was. And that's a very compelling argument. I mean, they're both compelling arguments. So notice just rhetorically how that's working. I mean, just the argument about corruption and the dangers of political power and just knowing how humans are. If that were the only objection to socialism, to say, no, you cannot have a handful of people being in charge of food, shelter, clothing, and medical care for everybody else, and in charge of the press. I mean, think of it that way too. Under socialism, you can have, if you want, freedom of the press, but that's a sham. That if the government owns all of the newspapers and owns all the television studios and owns all the radio broadcasting stations and owns all the publishing companies that make books, well then, what does it mean to say there's freedom of the press? That it can't be that anybody who wants to voice an opinion can write a 300-page book and get thousands and thousands of copies of that book printed. That can't be what freedom of the press means, because there's resources are scarce, right? If everybody in society had his or her own book, and they each wanted enough copies printed for every household, well, that just wouldn't work. That'd be a waste of resources. You couldn't do that. And so the point is, the state is going to have to decide which books get printed and which don't. The state is going to have to decide, under socialism, what shows appear on the 6 o'clock news. And the state's going to have to decide what gets printed in the newspapers. You know, somebody sends a letter to the editor complaining about something, it's ultimately the state and the owner of the machinery that cranks out the newspapers that will decide, is that letter to the editor critical of the government going to get published or not? And so when you just start framing it like that, you realize that is a horrible system. You're just asking for tyranny, right? So that's a great argument, and that, to me, would be decisive right there. Like, we know how a market economy works. And yeah, maybe there's aspects of it we don't like, that there are rich people running around gorging themselves and then going and throwing up in the bathroom while there's people starving, living under a bridge. And that, you know, that's, it's okay to say that's a horrible outcome. Doesn't make you a communist by saying that. But as bad as certain things may be that happen under a market economy, the point is, would socialism fix that? And no. Or you could say maybe it would fix that, but it would lead to all sorts of other horrendous problems that are far worse. All right. So the corruption argument is very strong, or the, you know, just the idea of concentrated power being dangerous. So, but then the incentive argument, which would have been stressed more by people who had studied economics, rhetorically, what they'll do is they'll say, let's put the danger of political power to one side and just focus on the pure economics of it. Right? So that's rhetorically how it works. So it just makes the case stronger. Okay, so in response to that, what did the socialist writers say? They said, oh, yeah, you're right. With people as they are right now, we agree with you. Everyone's real acquisitive and greedy, and everyone's just looking out for himself or maybe his family. And they don't really care about their fellow man. And so we can understand why you would think if we switched to a new socialist order that output would collapse and nobody would want to go to the – all the workers at the factories would just shirk. And, you know, they would just do the bare minimum, but they would have no interest in contributing to total output because they would know their particular share is going to be barely influenced by how much they personally contribute. And I said, but that's because you're looking at people who have been corrupted by growing up under capitalism. Because in a capitalist system, you have to be greedy and grasping and just look out for numero uno, or else you'll starve to death. That's how capitalism works. It's like Darwinism in the biological realm in social human interactions, economics. And, you know, there were defenders of the capitalist order who explicitly used that analogy, right? So that social Darwinism was not a smear term. There were people who proudly said, yeah, it's Darwinism. That's how capitalism works, just like in biology. Right, so the socialist writers said, you're not seeing human nature. You're seeing humans who have grown up under the brutalizing system known as capitalism, or the market economy, whatever you want to call it. And so they said there would be a new socialist man who would arise. When we had a socialist system, the infants born there who have grown up in a world where their needs are going to be taken care of, right? So they don't need to be thinking about, oh man, I gotta get a job. I gotta, you know, where am I gonna get my next paycheck from? I got a family to support. Oh man, and you start, you know, making these horrible decisions. They ethically challenge you or whatever because, well, I gotta eat. I gotta, you know, take care of my kids. And they're saying, if you take away all those worries, and they know that their basic needs are going to be taken care of, then they would flourish as humans, and they would just want to seek out and help their fellow men. So it was an argument over human nature, is what I'm getting at. And the socialists were very optimistic in that sense, whereas especially the conservatives, but even a lot of who we would call classical liberals were much more pessimistic. Okay, so, but at this point, there's kind of a stalemate, at least in terms of the theory. And then it would sort of be up to say, well, let's try it and see what happens. So that's the scene in which Mises now comes with his argument about socialist calculation. Now, so for tonight's lecture here, I'm just giving you guys the big picture, and I want you to see the content of the arguments and the rhetorical back and forth. If you want to know like the actual articles and the chronology and what date was such and such published, that's why I assigned for you. And if you go to the syllabus, it's I said like the first 4 1/4 pages or something like that of I have a journal article on the socialist calculation debate. So that's the purpose of me assigning that for you guys. It's not for the main idea of that paper that I wrote, because I was just extending something, bringing in something from that. So don't worry about it. If you're curious, you can read it. But I'm just, that was why I assigned you guys that, because I knew that there was a very concise chronology of this happened, and this happened, and that happened. It gave me a citation if you want to go see the stuff in more detail. Okay, so what was Mises' calculation argument? Well, rhetorically, he's going to one-up even the economists. So remember, you had this sort of just call it a conservative nature, human nature objection about, oh, power corrupts. You can't give somebody that much power. It upsets the normal distribution or the normal way of doing things. And just anytime you have massive reform like that, things happen and a bunch of people end up dead. You know, that's sort of the generic conservative fear of the socialist reformers. And then you had more economic-minded ones saying there's this incentive issue. But the socialist responded to both of them saying, no, no, no. You misunderstand how humans operate. Trust us. If we had a society of people who were raised under this system, they would have nothing but benevolence for their fellow man. They would all be comrades. And why wouldn't you want to go to the factory and put in an honest day's work and contribute? Why wouldn't you want to do that? You know, people are nice. People like to share. You see, when little kids are playing, and a lot of times it works out great, and that, you know, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling from helping somebody, and we just want to take that and channel it. All right, so that's the idea. So Mises comes along, and he has an argument that says, you know what? Let's stipulate for the sake of argument that everybody is benevolent. So the planners are, the central planners, the people running the socialist system, let's assume they really do have the good of the country or the population as their goal, right? So they're not secretly despots or power-hungry monsters. Let's just put that aside. Let's assume that they really are there to help everybody. Let's also assume, just for the sake of argument, that the workers and everybody else are enthusiastic about doing whatever the plan calls them to do. All right, so if somebody is capable under capitalism of going to the coal mines and, you know, almost ruining his body by bringing out so much coal over the course of a 20-year career, or somebody goes to a car factory and just cranks out stuff and it's a monotonous job or whatever, but he's willing to do it for wages under capitalism, well, then assume those human beings are just as willing to work just as hard if that's what the grand plan under the socialist system calls for. Okay, so Mises is conceding the issue about, you know, the power, corruption of power, and he's conceding the incentive problem that could plague socialism. And he's saying still, fundamentally, qualitatively, there is something that makes socialism not work as a system for allocating resources. And that's what we, so you can see, you know, it's called economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. And so that's what we nowadays often refer to as Mises' calculation argument. Okay, so if you want an elaborated version that's much more careful and nuanced, I gave you guys the YouTube link to Joe Salerno's lecture. But let me boil it down to the essentials for you guys right now. Here's how it goes. Let me type this out so you don't get too lost. All right, so if the state owns factors of production, then no real markets in them. Two, if no real markets, no real prices for resources, and then three, if no real prices, no legitimate calculation of profit or loss. Okay? So, the first step in the argument. So notice the power of this argument, and you can see why I stressed at the beginning, in order for this to go through, when we say socialism, what we need to have, a necessary condition, is that the state owns the means of production. And whether the state owns the TV in your house as a consumer, that doesn't really matter. But it has to be that the state owns the farmland and the tractors and the factories and the steel works and things like that. Okay. So if the state owns all that stuff, and that's really, historically, that's what socialism was. There were all kinds of variants, but if socialism is supposed to replace the anarchy of the market, that's the whole point, that the socialist writers thought the capitalist system or the market economy was without a rudder. It was like, not only did they think it had certain outcomes that were excessive and that they found repulsive morally, but the whole system to them seemed like anarchy in the bad pejorative sense of the word, that nobody's in charge. What the heck? There's no smart, wise person, good moral person overseeing everything to make sure that this outcome makes sense. And so that's how we have these crazy, ridiculous outcomes where a few people in top hats are driving around 16 sports cars and having garages full of luxury cars they barely ever even use. And then over here, you got thousands of people living on the verge of starvation. It's because nobody's in charge who can just put a stop to this crazy distribution, right? That's the mentality. So in order to fix that, if you want to have rationality in production, the state has to be in control. The state has to control the means of production. That's the whole point. That's the beauty of socialism from their point of view, that it gets rid of the so-called anarchy of production that happens under a market economy. Okay, so Mises' point is pretty straightforward, or argument is pretty straightforward. Okay, if the state owns the factors of production, then there aren't any real markets in them. I mean, you could have fake markets where some people pretend to go through the motions of buying and selling, but if the state is the owner of everything, well, if the state can't buy it from itself, who's it selling to? Right? If you're the owner. So if there's no real markets, then there aren't legitimate market prices that explain the terms on which various types of resources can trade for other resources. Right? So and then the last point, if there's no prices, then you can't make legitimate calculations of profit and loss. So what does that mean? Well, remember, in a market economy, how does a particular enterprise know if it's doing a good job or not? Well, the accountants run the books periodically, and they can tell the owners whether the firm is profitable or not. And so there's a sense in which if a firm is profitable, what that means is it's taking resources that have a certain market value and it's transforming them into goods and services that have a higher market value. That's what it means to be turning a profit, right? That you're buying resources, let's say for $1,000, you're combining them with each other and producing stuff that you're selling to your customers for $1,100. And so you just made a 10% return on your invested capital. So if you're suffering losses, what does that mean? It means you're taking resources that you had to spend, let's say, $1,000 on, and you're using them to create goods and services that, oh, you can only sell for $900. And so you lost money. And so, again, just step back and think about what that's saying. If you're profitable, you're creating goods and services that have a higher market value than the resources you had to withdraw from other potential enterprises to make the stuff that you sold for that amount of money. And vice versa if you're unprofitable. All right, so Mises acknowledges that that's not a perfect criterion. For one thing, it makes the consumers and their preferences and their willingness to spend money on certain things, it makes them ultimately steer the ship. That if consumers really like smoking cigarettes and they're going to spend a lot of money on the first few packs of cigarettes every week, then the market pricing system will be such that people will find it profitable to buy tobacco from farmers and to roll them in, or, you know, make cigarettes out of them and sell them. And then the farmers will find that it's profitable to plant tobacco in at least certain portions of their land rather than other possible crops they could plant. And so when you say, does that make sense or not? Well, ultimately, you're deferring to the wishes of the consumers. And so if you want to say, no, they're a bunch of idiots, they're killing themselves and they don't know it, okay. But Mises is saying, at least there is some rationality there, with that in quotation marks, in a certain sense, which you're understanding from the context of what we mean, a certain order to it. It's ultimately reflecting the consumer's preferences. Now, it's also true that the intensity with which a certain consumer can influence the structure of production is based on how much money he or she has. And how do they get the money? Well, in their capacity as producers in a market economy. And so that it all fits together. And so ultimately, the amount you contribute in turn reflects the capacity you have to influence the structure of production, because how much money you have to enter the consumer markets is ultimately based on either how much you personally produced or somebody before produced and gave to you to give you the decision-making power. All right, so Mises is saying under socialism, you don't have that. And it's not an issue about incentives. It's not an issue about the people in charge possibly being evil. It has to do with just the nature of the system, that there's no way, even after the fact, to ask this particular enterprise, is it making an efficient use of the scarce resources at society's disposal? Because, and here's the kicker, as Mises says, let's even stipulate that the planners, when they're drawing up the blueprints, that they have all of the relevant technical information, right? So that they're, so it's not just that, oh, having 100 people ultimately be in charge of planning the whole economy would be bad because those 100 people might not know everything. And Mises is saying, he's assuming that problem away also. He's saying, suppose they can interrogate and get research reports and answer, you know, surveys or whatever, in any kind of technical information, the best doctors can tell them the pros and cons of various surgery techniques or various treatments, let's say. Like, oh yeah, somebody who's suffering from cancer, we could do an aggressive chemotherapy, and here's, you know, the types of resources it would take, and here's the odds of it improving, you know, the expected lifespan, blah, 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 blah. Or we could just do such and such, and you know, you could do that kind of stuff. And you could, they could talk to the engineers who could tell them what you want. You want to build a railroad connecting New York and LA? Okay. Well, you want us to show you some possible routes? Okay, and they can give you all the technical information. Say, if we go this way, this northern route will use this many tons of steel and this many cords of wood. And then the trains that run on this route would use this much coal per year. And and they could go through and give a bunch of technical engineering facts. Whereas if we go a longer route this way and use steam engines or whatever, you know, I'm making stuff up, or diesel engines, I should say. All right, and they can give all kinds of technical facts. But the point is, at the end of the day, the planners would just have a bunch of information saying, here's different technological recipes. You could take these various resources we have at our disposal, and you could combine them in all these different permutations and combinations to get possible sets of outputs. And how do we know what to do? That is the fundamental problem. So Mises is saying without market prices, you don't know, because specifically what the problem is, you don't know what the relative economic value is of different units of the factors of production. So if, you know, if you want to say, we want to build a house for somebody, what's the best way to do it? And there's different ways you can build a house. You could build it out of wood. You could build it mostly out of brick. You could build it out of cardboard. It wouldn't be a very sturdy house. Right? There's different ways you could do it. But even the same, you know, fairly specific house, like the well-defined, or no, maybe not even a house, like getting apples to somebody. You say, we want to get some apples to the people in Alaska. How do we do it? Well, you could have a greenhouse in Alaska. That's one way to do it. Or you could plant more trees elsewhere and harvest the apple, the extra apples, and then ship them up to Alaska. And so there's different ways. And so the point is to answer that question, to say, to get one more bushel of apples per year in the hands of people in Alaska, given, let's just assume we want to do that, that's a good thing. What's the cheapest way to do that, or the most efficient way to do that? Well, in a market economy, that's easy. You say, what's the way to do that that spends the least amount of money on resources? That's the answer. That's the cheapest way to do it. And then you also know, should it be done at all? The question, you answer that question by saying, well, would the consumers in Alaska pay more dollars for that next bushel of apples than it would cost us to produce it? Is the marginal revenue higher than the marginal cost? And if the answer is yes, then the answer is okay. You all do it as cheaply as possible, but then you also to say, do we keep producing more units of this? You ask on the margin, are we getting paid enough to cover our marginal costs? Okay, but under socialism, there are no marginal revenues, there are no marginal costs. We don't know what they are, right? So that's the fundamental problem. It's that even if you knew you had to produce something, which you wouldn't know, but even if you knew, or for the sake of argument, said, let's build this house on this location in San Francisco. Well, there's different ways of building a house, and you wouldn't know what's the most efficient way to build the house. You would have different facts. So we could use this much wood, we could use this much steel, we could use this much concrete, this many bricks, and there'd be different trade-offs involved, and you would just be looking at numbers that you wouldn't know how to. You wouldn't be able to reduce them to a common denominator, because that's ultimately what you get with accounting and money prices under capitalism, is you can take a bunch of facts about various things and reduce it to a number, reduce it to dollars and cents. So notice that's what horrifies people about capitalism. The people who just recoil at the very idea, like you think it's dirty, Mises is saying, no, that's its virtue. You need that. You have to be able, at least for the purposes of accounting and making economic decisions, you have to be able to take certain things that are very complex and reduce them to simple numbers. And if you're going to do that, what are the dimensions of that number? Well, it has to be denominated in terms of money. That's really what it has to be if we're talking about economic decisions. That's the crucial thing. Right? Like I said, with the apple, to say, okay, yeah, the consumers in Alaska, if we're going to give them one more bushel of apples per year, what's the most efficient way to do that? That's not the same thing as saying, what's the way to do it while minimizing how much steel we use or minimizing how much more gasoline we burn up getting in those. That doesn't matter. Maybe we should burn up more gasoline. Or you see what I'm saying? That there's different ways of doing it. So let me just say one more thing on this and I'll move on. I want to cover other topics tonight. The big picture of what's happening here is that when you withdraw scarce resources into a particular application to make more of a service or a consumer good, those resources necessarily cannot be used elsewhere. And so in the fact that the resources are heterogeneous means that if to make that extra bushel of apples to give them to people in Alaska, if you use a method that burns a lot of gasoline but doesn't use much more coal, well, then that has certain implications. If instead you get them that extra thing by using a technique that burns more coal but doesn't really take much more gasoline. So like maybe the difference is getting it there by truck as opposed to by a train that uses coal. Well, those have different implications because gasoline and coal are not perfect substitutes. There are certain production processes for which gasoline is more suitable than coal and vice versa. And so in any particular application, if you choose to use more gasoline to get the job done as opposed to more coal, well, then that has different ramifications on what other goods around the economy have to now be restricted in order to do what you just did. So think of it like that. Given how resources are being used to crank out stuff year after year, now the central planners are looking at that and they're saying, huh, maybe we should tweak the dials a little bit. And the point, Mises's point is, okay, they can do that. They can know technologically, you know, oh, if we want to produce one more bushel of apple per year in Alaska, they can do it. They have the power. But that necessarily means when they do that, outputs elsewhere are going to have to shrink because there's scarcity. There's opportunity cost. And the point is, in a complex modern economy with millions and millions of different types of resources, the combinations are, I'm going to say virtually infinite, doesn't really mean, but you get what I'm saying, they're incalculable. And so you have no way of knowing whether you're doing the job or not, even after the fact. Okay, let me move on here so we don't get totally bogged down on that point. So the socialist theorists responded to Mises. And at first, some of them just said, no, this guy Mises is crazy. He doesn't get it. And they just ignored him. But to their credit, the more academic theoretical economists who were also socialists recognized that Mises had made a really good point. And so they came in and they answered him using the framework of mathematical economics. And it was this period of the socialist calculation debate when Mises realized his thinking had really deviated from mainstream economics. Okay, so in his earlier work, in his like methodological work writings, where Mises is explaining this is how economists operate, this is how we, you know, our discipline is different from math, but it's also different from history, and it's different from physics. And so in his early methodological work, where Mises is trying to explain how economics is its own discipline and has its own internal method, he wasn't wagging his finger at other economists saying, what are you doing? Do it like this. He thought he was explaining this is how we economists think, and this is how we work, and this is what our field is. But then by the time he hits the socialist calculation debate, he starts to realize, well, these other economists using these mathematical techniques, they think differently from the way I do and what I think is solid economics. Okay, so anyway, Lange and Lerner were the two most prominent people to respond in what's now called the socialist calculation debate. And they said basically that the socialist planners could mimic the market process. So that, for example, the central planners could pick a bunch of people, you know, and say to this guy, your job is you're in charge of this factory. Your job is you're in charge of that factory. Okay, now this factory, what you're doing is you're producing steel. And this guy over here, what you're doing is producing cars, and you need steel to make the cars, obviously. So what we're going to have you do is, you know, part of you're following our instructions, because we're the socialist rulers, we're the heads of the party. We want you to pretend that you're in a capitalist system and that you're trying to make profits for your firm. It's not really a firm. We own everything. But this is what our instructions to you are. It's like you're playing a game. And so we're going to announce various prices, which are the terms of exchange, by which you, the head of the car factory, can acquire steel from this guy. And then when you make your cars for the comrades, they're going to go to the distribution centers and they're going to pay with money that they get from their jobs. And that's, okay, and so you see how it works. And so they're going to come up with this elaborate system where they're mimicking socialism. And they actually call it market socialism. That's the way that's what it came out to be. So, and so they were saying, using the techniques of mainstream mathematical economics, we can prove mathematically that under this scenario that we've described, the central planners could keep announcing prices and then tell everybody to optimize on the basis of those official central planning board announced prices. And then once all the market's cleared, boom, you're done. And they would say, so we could certainly mimic what a socialist or what a market economy could do, but then we could improve upon it also, because there are certain flaws in the decentralized market process, and we could specifically address those with this system. All right, so notice the logic there. They're saying one way of explaining it is they're saying, look, we know how a market economy works because in mathematical economics, we've developed models that have solutions to them. You know, mathematically, we can write out a system of equations to characterize a decentralized market economy. And we have theorems, and we can prove that there exists a solution. And we know in the real world, entrepreneurs stumble upon and find that solution. And that's how markets work. That's how capitalism works. So we could do the same thing under socialism, at least. So socialism is no worse than capitalism. And then if we want, we can tweak it. Because there are certain things, like there's too much advertising for athletic shoes under capitalism. You don't need a bunch of advertising for sneakers. That's stupid. So we won't do that. Things like that. All right. So, and this, incidentally, that survives to when I was in NYU. This would have been, I don't know, let's say the year 2001, around there. I was talking to this guy that was in my program, so I'm getting a PhD at this point, and he's in the same program. He's getting a PhD in economics from NYU, which at the time was, I don't know, top 15 school in the world. And somehow the issue of the Austrian economic calculation debate, socialist calculation debate, came up. And I was just saying matter-of-factly about how, you know, the Austrians dominated. And he said, what are you talking about? And he said, no, the socialists proved socialism can at least do as well as capitalism. And then, obviously, then it has the freedom to do even better. All right, and he wasn't being ironic or making a joke. He was dead serious, and the guy was very smart. And so that, for me, I sort of had like a Mises moment where I realized, oh my gosh, you guys really take these mathematical models seriously. Okay, because up till that point, I thought we all knew that we were studying these mathematical models of the economy, but knew these were just kind of like little toy models. Like it's like telling a fairy tale. And then forgetting that it's a fairy tale and thinking that was a history lesson. So you get what I'm saying? Like they really thought the market economy was adequately described by these real simplistic mathematical models. Okay, so that's what these guys did. So now, so they said Mises provided a very valuable service to the future socialist commonwealth by pointing out a little hitch, a complication. But now we've resolved it theoretically, and there you go. That's not really this crushing problem that Mises thought it was, but he was right to bring it up. Yes, we do need economic calculation, but we do not need private property. So that's, let me type that out. That's a good way of summarizing it. They said, yes, Mises, we need economic calculation, but we don't need private property. All right, and I'm putting the quotation marks. Make sure, don't put this on Facebook next to my face and say Robert Murphy, 2014. I'm not saying that these guys are. I'm paraphrasing their argument because I think that's a good way for you to understand what their position was. So they really were saying, yes, Mises, you did clarify. Thank you. And okay, so it's actually, just so you know, it's kind of neat in this debate. Both sides are somewhat courteous to each other. Like Mises actually is glad, like, you know, I can't remember the way he put it, but you get the sense that he's kind of saying, well, thank goodness at least there's some economists over there in the socialist camp that, you know, give me the time of day here and they understand I put my finger on a really big issue and they're at least trying to grapple with it, as opposed to these nincompoops who keep writing as if they don't even need money. Right? So these guys knew, yeah, you do need a system of accounting. You need to be able to convert everything to a single dimension, a common denominator. It's just they thought that they came up with a clever proposal by which the central planning board could give a bunch of specific instructions and issue prices that were just the terms of exchange among the comrades who had been anointed to head up the factories. Okay. So Hayek comes along, and he, first of all, says, everybody, whoop, time out here. Look at how far we've come. The whole appeal historically of socialism was to get rid of the anarchy of production under the market. The whole appeal was to get rid of money. So why do we need to, you know, have something as important as how many gallons of milk made for babies or something is produced, and how many diapers and how much housing for poor people? Under capitalism, those decisions are decided upon by the bottom line, the profit and loss test, and that was what horrified everybody. And they wanted those decisions to be made on the basis of considerations of compassion and need and things like that, emotional things, and our sense of justice, as opposed to a bunch of pencil whipping accountants just going ahead and run the numbers. And so Hayek is saying, look at how far they've come, that under these proposals of market socialism, they have, it's like capitalism, except for that one little thing about who the owner is. You know, the whole system has come full circle to basically capitalism once again, as they keep acknowledging the problems with their pre-existing proposals. And they keep tweaking it. They keep moving it closer and closer back to capitalism, so that it's not even a shadow of what the original socialists, like in the 1870s, were advocating. Okay, so that's one thing. And then he says, now he does make a strategic move that arguably comes back to bite him, is that Hayek says that, yeah, in principle, you could have the market socialist solution the way Lange and Lerner describe it. And he says, but in practice, come on, there would need to be millions and millions of equations. And so, and then also, he focuses on this idea of dispersed knowledge. And so he's saying, in reality, you have a lot of specialized knowledge dispersed throughout the economy. And so even if you had supercomputers, and even if you had a bunch of crack mathematicians who could solve these equations or whatever, that in practice, what Lange and Lerner are suggesting that could replace and mimic a market economy is nonsense. And he's saying, because under a market, prices are a communication system. Communication system. Okay, so this Hayek is now, and if you look at his career, you know, as he's responding to market socialism, he starts thinking more, and he comes out with his famous paper, which are often referred to as the knowledge papers. Like, I think it was in 1937, it's Economics and Knowledge. And then I think it was in 1945, it's a real famous one called The Use of Knowledge in Society. All right, and so Hayek's understanding of how capitalism works kind of undergoes a flourishing or development here, a maturation, where he realizes under capitalism, we have all this dispersed knowledge. So there is no central decision-making body, and all those decisions are spread out over various people, and there is no person that really surveys the whole thing and knows what's going on. That's the whole beauty of it. It's a decentralized network where prices convey the essentials. And so if there's a collapse of a tin mine somewhere, the world price of tin shoots up, and everybody economizes on tin around the world, but they don't have to know a mine collapsed. They don't even know why. They just need to know that tin is now more scarce than it was yesterday. And so that's the understanding of how it comes up. And so then when he's looking at it like that, he realizes just how ludicrous these proposals for market socialism are. Okay, so I kind of summarized there for you the back and forth of the debate. And last thing I'll make on this point, well, I'll make two more points. So you can see there is a distinction between Mises and Hayek on this, in this debate. All right, so I'm not saying one's right and the other one's wrong by any stretch. I think they're both right, but Mises' calculation argument is distinct from Hayek's knowledge argument. Because Mises was conceding for the sake of argument that the central planners would be able to get all the technical knowledge, right? That's one point. Another point is this issue of what about the fall of the USSR? Okay, now here, just so you guys know the situation, I am pretty sure everything I said will that you know anybody who lectures at the Mises Institute would be fine with everything I said up till now. All right, this particular point that I'm going to talk on right now, there might be healthy disagreement about. All right, so let me just make the case for my position. Let me say what I'm critiquing. You will often hear people say something like, yeah, there was the socialist calculation debate in the early 1900s, and for a while the conventional wisdom was that Mises and Hayek had lost, but then with the fall of the Soviet Union, everybody realized Mises had won. Okay, so, I mean, I guess that's good that people who used to be Marxists or at least think that, oh, well, you know, have an open mind and maybe socialism works, I don't know. And at least they could see with their own eyes what happened and then said, okay, yeah. But strictly speaking, Mises was not making an empirical argument. He was not saying, so if there is a state system that tries to implement full-blown socialism, its days are numbered. That's not really the crux of the argument, because he often would, you know, the way people summarize it is for Mises to say economic calculation under socialism is impossible, right? So a lot of times people truncate that and say, oh, according to Mises, socialism is impossible. And no, that's not what he said. And if it is what he said, then he was wrong, because socialism obviously existed. Right, so if you say something's impossible and it lasted for 70 years, then you know it's kind of a weird way to say for something to be impossible. If it's you know lasted for 70 years, you could say human beings are impossible, at least the ones that died before that age. Okay, so I think it's much more precise and also correctly captures what Mises' point was, is to say economic calculation under socialism is impossible from day one. So even in the Soviet Union, at the point at which you want to say, yeah, at that point they had genuine socialism, it wasn't that a clock started running and after a while Mises' insights are going to kick in. No, it's from that moment Mises' insights kicked in, and then you could argue culturally, socially, politically, because they lacked economic calculation, their days were numbered. That's fine, but strictly speaking, that's a separate argument. Okay. Let me now clarify the clarification. I'm not, when I was saying there that, you know, some people will say, I didn't mean somebody to mean something to. What I mean, though, is I think sometimes they're nicer than I am and just let that kind of stuff go without correcting someone who might summarize it that way. Whereas I like to be real pedantic. That's what I meant. Right? So it's not that there's some major doctrinal disagreement. It's just more in terms of I personally don't like it when people say Mises was vindicated by the fall of the Soviet Union. Because to me, that's a weird statement, because well, that makes it sound like Mises was predicting the longevity of a socialist state with his calculation argument, and that's not really right. Okay. Let's see. As far as the empirical record, I'll be really quick here. Theory versus history. All I want to make sure you get here is, and this I cover in the textbook explicitly, let me just say it again for the record. You got to be really careful, because in the Austrian approach to economics, well, certainly in the tradition of Mises and Rothbard, in the beginning when we're first introducing somebody to the way Misesians approach economics and what economic science is, we hammer home how much it's not like physics or biology or chemistry. That we, it's not that we form conjectures or hypotheses that have testable implications, and then we go look at the data to see how did we do. Yeah, we hammer home, and that's actually, we get a lot of abuse for that. A lot of other economists from other schools will ridicule the Misesian as being anti-empirical or even anti-scientific, or unscientific would be a more normal sounding word. All right, and so we spend a lot of ink making that point, and so now I'm just acknowledging it might seem weird to you that, well, then how can you come right around and try to say history shows, and that's incidentally why I get so anal about the fall of the Soviet Union and how we discuss that, because I want to make sure we're being consistent with our methodological quibbles or stance. Okay, so but here, strictly speaking, I'm not saying the way we know Mises' calculation argument is right is by looking at the empirical record. All I'm saying, though, is, or one way of seeing it is, yeah, Mises could be right theoretically, but maybe that particular mechanism in the grand scheme isn't that important. You know, that's logically possible. So you could certainly isolate with a predictive rigor and certainty some relationship among things, but to be able to say in the grand scheme how important is it, that's not as obvious. Just like you could know that the minimum wage causes unemployment to go up, but and you could know that just by analyzing how it works, what it is. You know, you don't need to go test that the propositions involved. But then to say in practice, why did we have unemployment so high in 2009 and 2010? Well, is it just because they did raise the minimum wage then, or might it have been because of the business cycle? You see what I'm saying? There's different stuff going on. And so, strictly speaking, you don't know how relevant this theoretical insight is. And that's why it helps to study some of these so-called natural experiments. And I'm putting that in quotation marks, because in the social sciences, there is no controlled experiment. But having said that, come on. North and South Korea, it's the same people, the same type of cultures and whatever, and just one of them went totally communist and the other one stayed allied with the West. And then perhaps even a better example is Germany during the Cold War, between, you know, East Germany and West Germany. So even down to his particular city being cut in two. So that's the idea. Because if you say, well, Cuba, the standard of living is much lower there under Castro than it was in the United States, yeah, but there's lots of different things that could explain that, including the embargo. All right, or to say, oh, people in Russia were much poorer than people in France. Well, okay, but you know, there's lots of stuff going on there. Whereas when you had East and West Germany or North and South Korea, that was a much more crisp example of let's see what happens when one place goes under fairly strict socialism and the other place stays pretty much market economy. So what this picture is, it's an image from space at night, and you can see the difference in the lighting. And so North Korea is black there because very few people in North Korea have electricity. And so they don't have their lights on at night because they don't have electricity. So that's basically the point, is you can see it from space, the difference in these systems. Okay, and then the last thing, like I said, I'm not going to go over it. I'm just putting it in here in case you're not reading the textbook as a matter of course. I do want to make sure you know in the textbook I summarize some of the statistics about the body counts. Just and to be clear, the numbers in there, when they count how many millions of people died under various regimes, and those aren't counting war casualties, right? Rather, those are showing how many people were deliberately killed by their own governments for matters of domestic policy. And so just make sure you're aware of that, because there still is this default where when kids, or not even just kids, when people try to come up with, you know, who's the worst person in history, everybody says Adolf Hitler, or I suppose some real Christian people might say Judas, but very few people say Joseph Stalin or Pol Pot, even though, you know, depending on which metric you use, like total body count, or bringing up Chairman Mao, right? So depending on what metric you use, and you want to say how many total people did he kill, well, it's not Adolf Hitler. Or if you want to say what percentage of his own population did he kill, then it's not even close. All right, so I don't think that's a coincidence. It's because of the appeal of leftism, that communist tyrants and mass murderers get relatively a free pass in academia, whereas right-wing dictators do not. So now, having said, I hesitate to even say that stuff because it makes it sound like I'm saying, oh, come on, Adolf Hitler wasn't that big a deal. Of course, he was a monster, right? But the point is, it's just assumed that Adolf Hitler is the epitome of, you know, an evil government tyrant, when actually there were people who were worse on several dimensions, but they were all considered left-wing. And last thing I'll say is that dichotomy, or that spectrum that we have, is crazy. And when I talk about this in the textbook also, the idea that, if you go all the way to the left, you hit Joseph Stalin, and if you go all the way to the right, you hit Adolf Hitler. And so our nice democratic society is somewhere in the middle. That's a bad mental classification, which just rigs the deck in favor of statism, that a much more sensible spectrum would be government power or state power versus individual autonomy or private enterprise. And so on that scale, on one end you've got Rothbardian anarcho-capitalism, where you keep moving, you get into night watchman state, you keep moving, you get into like a welfare state, and then finally you get to pure socialism. And so remember, Nazi stands for National Socialist. And so we're not putting words in their mouth. The Nazi system clearly did not like laissez-faire capitalism. It did not like liberalism in the classical sense. Okay, I went a little bit long there, but let me now address your questions. So in case you're not sure, guys, if you do have questions for me, put them in the specifically marked Q&A box, because you guys are chit-chatting. It's hard for me to, in the main chat box, I can't easily grab questions that are just for me. Okay, so Gwen says or asks, how does market socialism compare to state capitalism? Are those synonyms or are there specific distinctions? Oh, that's it. I never even thought of that. Okay, so again, market socialism is the term used to describe the system that Oscar Lange and Abel Lerner proposed, where it was socialism, but people were supposed to mimic capitalist system. And then there's state capitalism, which I guess that would be like Gwen, what, who would it be, like communist China? Is that the kind of system you have in mind when you say state capitalism? Okay, she says yes. I guess they were, I'm trying to think. I would have to say, Gwen, that right now what they have in practice in China is more capitalism than what Lange and Lerner were proposing. And I probably shouldn't elaborate too much on this because I'm going to end up saying something silly and have to later retract it because I don't consider myself an expert in China. There's, just so everybody knows, I mean, there's various degrees of economic freedom. In North Korea, it is awful. All right, so if you had to pick to live somewhere, you would much rather live in communist China than in North Korea right now. All right, they're, I mean, they were literally people, I'm not trying to gross people out, but you can even see disgusting pictures. And I mean, there was mass famine in North Korea not too long ago where people were literally engaging in cannibalism. Right, I mean, so it's bad. Whereas in communist China, yeah, it's not like that's where Bill Gates wants to go and retire, but they do keep liberalizing. I think part of it also is the direction they're moving in. That in China they have been liberalizing. So under Mao, and red China was awful also, and there were millions of people dying. And so starting from that baseline to then start liberalizing, things keep getting better and better. So that's partly why China has such rapid economic growth, is that economic growth measured from the percentage increase in output. But to the extent that you even believe those figures, it makes sense that they're freeing up their markets. So they, just part of the reason I'm saying that, Gwen, is I did do a little bit of work on China when I worked for a firm. I was doing some one-off research papers for them a couple of years ago, and that guy was really into Asian markets, in terms of giving advice to his investors. And so we were looking. So China is doing a lot of stuff like regional free trade agreements. So they're not literally free trade, but you know what I'm talking about, like the way these guys describe free trade agreements. So China is, the people in charge of the Communist Party in China, I think they're not bad economists. They understand how markets work. And I think they just face a bunch of institutional constraints and they have to make decisions about, well, gee, we can't give too much freedom or else our government will fall. But they do understand how markets work, and they understand incentives and things like that. And they are, I don't know if they ended up going through it, but like we did a whole paper on them giving limited ownership rights in real estate, because the deal was the peasants like control these tiny little parcels of land, and it was really inefficient because like an outside company couldn't come in, like a Western firm couldn't come in and make an arrangement with all of them to bring all their plots of land under one unified system of ownership to then bring in, big agricultural equipment and stuff, like to have wide irrigation and fertilization and that kind of stuff. Like it wouldn't make sense. You wouldn't get a big tractor on your little dinky plot of land. That would be silly. But if you combine all the plots of land into one big one, then it would make sense to get a big tractor. That kind of deal. And so the Chinese officials were, as of when we did this paper a couple of years ago, were looking into liberalizing that and giving the peasants the legal ability to do that, to make those sorts of contractual arrangements with the outside company. Okay, so that's That's what I mean. That yeah, it may be still a nominally communist system, but they are liberalizing, and there's pockets of individual entrepreneurship and markets that are continually expanding, at least as of the last time I studied it. Okay, why don't we stop there because we're over time. So, Steve, I see you chimed in. Just so you guys know, I keep track of the questions, and then I will, at the very least, by the end of the course, if I haven't done it already, I'll catch up with everybody. But why don't we stop there because we're at the time. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and make sure you do your reading for next time for the optimal results. And I will send out an email explaining when the office hours are going to be for this weekend.